There is so much happening right now that it can feel like a constant onslaught of news. This is, by any measure, an extraordinary moment in American history. The presidency of Barack Obama is coming to a close. Donald Trump is about to assume the office. And we are here trying to make sense of what this moment means for our economy, our country, all of us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're devoting most of the show to trying to understand this new paradigm, what it means to have a president-elect with business holdings all over the world, how direct communication via tweet can make economic policy and move markets, and what the American relationship with Russia really is now in 2017. Plus, you know, a little time with the new host of A Prairie Home Companion. Come talk with us, as always, on Marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are starting this week's show, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and apply it to the news. Here to join me this week is Marketplace's Lewis Wallace and Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, Jillian White. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Jillian, you are the out of the family, although part of our show family guest today. I guess I would like you to go first and lay out your long for us.
Yeah, so my long is related to President Obama's farewell speech, and my long is his legacy, specifically as a job creator. And Obama's record as a job creator comes with, you know, some caveats. Since he started such a bad period, a lot of that growth is attributable to the fact that things were pretty horrific before he got here. But I think in the end, history is going to remember him as someone, as a president who did a lot of good for the job market, who, you know, presided over a lot of important growth.
You know, Jillian, one of the big questions here, though, and you mentioned the caveats, but can any president, no matter the party, be a job creator? A lot of economists say, look, the majority of jobs come from the private sector, and the best thing that any federal policy can do is sort of tweak at the edges. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I think it's absolutely true, and I would agree with economists that presidents do not by themselves create job growth or anything like that. But I do think that presidents and their administrations and the people that they pick to fill those administrations help set a tone and help pick and choose policies and influence policies that can really help or can really hurt. And I think in the case of Obama, you know, we saw some growth, and I think you do have to give him and the people that he chose to put in his cabinet and to put in place some credit for that.
Lewis, you spent a lot of time interviewing folks who voted for Donald Trump. Did they give President Obama any credit for job creation?
No. I mean, so much of the narrative during the election season, as everybody knows, was focused on the places where there aren't jobs or where the jobs have really changed. So I was in Ohio for a while talking to folks there, largely in places where it's not so much that there's a high unemployment rate or a lot of people sort of sitting around, but the nature of the work has changed and the kinds of steady, stable, middle-income jobs that people used to have seem to be gone. And the tone there was a lot of that was blamed on President Obama.
I mean, I do think that as we look ahead into this, you know, incoming administration, and really even setting aside the administration, the economy of the future, the big question is wages, right? I mean, do the jobs that we are creating now in 2017, 2018, 2020, do they pay enough for a solid middle class life?
Yeah, wages, and I think the relationship to work, too, you know, how you feel about your job, whether you take pride in it, whether it's a source of community and connection to other people. And so much of that has changed just drastically over the last, you know, 20, 30 years. Obviously, that can't really be attributed to President Obama, but I think President-elect Trump has kind of attached himself to the tone of that conversation very effectively. And now we see him also starting to take credit for jobs that are coming in or that are staying in the United States in a way that President Obama hasn't kind of taken credit for.
Some of which may be attributable to him and some of which are not. All right, Lewis, I want to pivot to your long because I guess it's a certain kind of work that you're thinking about. Tell me what your long.
long on private prisons, the private prison industry. So it's a really interesting kind of shifting moment for that industry. It's about a $5 billion industry in the U.S. Each year. And before the presidential election, we saw kind of a downturn there. Stocks were down. Last summer, the Federal Bureau of Prisons announced that it would be phasing out its use of private prisons, which industry-wide wouldn't have had a huge, huge effect because most private prisons are state prisons or they're federal immigrant detention centers, which is a different type of facility. In any case, a lot of people saw it as sort of a sign that private prisons had seen their heyday and that was going to be over. As soon as the election happened, stocks soared in private prisons. Some of that is because of what Donald Trump is expected to do with immigration, could increase the numbers of people being detained, and most of those facilities are run by private prison companies. Some of that has to do with, you know, the actual Federal Bureau of Prisons side. So Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearings this week are definitely a sign that things could be turning around for private prison companies. He's really been a supporter of privatization, and he would be the person as Attorney General overseeing that decision for the Bureau of Prisons about whether or not to continue its contracts with private prisons. And so far, none of those private prisons have actually been closed. So I was recently down in Georgia in a couple different places with private facilities, prison and detention center, in them, kind of reporting on some of that uncertainty and what people in those local communities are thinking.
Yeah, I'm totally with Lewis on this. I think this is one of those things that you just see the moment being ripe for things to really change course.
Jillian, you had an excellent story this week about credit and credit services. And I know this is where your short comes into play, but it's one of those things that I think, though all Americans depend on credit, we don't understand it very well. Explain your short.
Yeah, I am short paid credit monitoring or improvement services. So right after I wrote that story, I actually saw a bunch of commercials where it was, you know, you pay for a subscription service and they monitor your credit and they help you get bad marks off of it and they help you to improve your score. I am short this because the CFPB recently fined two of the big three credit reporting agencies for essentially selling credit monitoring services and kind of misleading people about the scores that they were selling, and then also trapping them into paid subscriptions. They didn't really disclose what they were doing. But some of these paid services, you don't actually need them. The federal government requires that these reporting agencies actually give Americans their credit score at least once during every 12-month period.
For free.
For free. So, you know, it is your legal right as an American citizen to get this. And you can go over your report yourself and say, hey, I didn't do that, or that's not me, or that's not my account, and kind of try and hash it out. And it takes more time and effort, but I think more Americans are going to become aware of their rights in this area and realize that they probably don't need to be paying a random service to do it for them.
How important do you think the CFPB is to making sure that people are aware of that? And I'm curious what you think could change under President Donald Trump.
Yeah, so I think in this moment, the CFPB has been pretty instrumental in pushing Americans to know their rights in the area of credit and credit scoring. And I think you're right. We don't know really what happens under Trump administration. He has said flat out several times that he thinks the CFPB is a bad idea and he wants to either seriously hinder their power, if not completely shut them down. That being said, I think this is an area where lots of people can get involved. Lots of financial advocates can get involved. It's a pretty easy thing to fix since some of the fixes are already in place. You know, some of these laws have already been passed to make it accessible and transparent for people. They just need to know about it.
And I would add that one of the interesting things about the CFPB, unlike many other agencies in Washington, is in its creation, its funding mechanism, and I know this sounds really wonky, was set up essentially to protect it from any attempt to defund it in the future. It is funded differently than a lot of other agencies. Now,
yes,
that may not survive a lot of, you know, attacks if, say, the Dodd-Frank law is dismantled. But it does have, I would say, a sort of a shield that other agencies in D.C. do not. I want to turn us to Lewis's short because, man, we have talked about this thing so much and I don't even know what it means anymore. And I guess that's the point. Lewis?
I am short fake news. not so much the phenomenon, but the phrase. And I feel like the big sign for me was that this week Breitbart ran an article that just openly referred to CNN and BuzzFeed as fake news outlets, no quotations. In my opinion, fake news has gone so quickly from being kind of a useful characterization to talk about news that's not based in fact to being kind of part of this whole name-calling game. Anything you don't like, you just call it fake news and dismiss it. The business angle here and where I'm kind of going with this is that I think all of us in the news business and all of us as consumers are facing these really complicated questions about where do ethics and factuality fit into online business news models. We know Breitbart has fanned the flames of, I'll say, non-truth-based phenomena like birtherism and been very successful. This week, I looked at some analytics that said Breitbart has more visitors these days than the Washington Post or BuzzFeed or Fox News.
Wow.
How much does whether or not something is fake news matter to the business model is a very serious question
and
for all
of
us.
And to the consumer.
Right.
We are thinking about this as journalists, but when we think about it as consumers of news, how do you choose what you believe? How do you choose where you want to go for your news? Those are things that I don't know if people have figured out good answers to yet.
Yeah, and what is that line between work that is transparent about its perspective and work that is not grounded in truth and fact? Breitbart is a good example of an outlet that kind of is right on that tricky line. And I think a lot of people like it because it comes out and says where it's coming from. It says, we're all right. We're not afraid to say what we think. But we're seeing just the rise of so many other news websites that are imitating that on various points of the spectrum of actually fact-checking things and making sure that they're based in truth.
These are such confusing times, guys.
Oh, my goodness.
Marketplace's Lewis Wallace, Jillian White from The Atlantic. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We have talked on this show about President-elect Donald Trump's potential conflicts of interest between his businesses and being president. This week, of course, he had a press conference to lay out his plans. The brief gist, he's handing over control of the Trump Organization to his older sons and a business associate. New foreign deals will not be allowed. New domestic deals will. He's putting his assets into a trust, but Trump can look at an overall profit and loss statement. In addition, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will join the administration as a senior advisor. We've got John Michaels on to talk about all this. He is a law professor at UCLA. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The head of the Office of Government Ethics said this would leave the president-elect open to suspicion of corruption. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a staggering number of issues here. It's almost hard to know where to start. This isn't a blind trust. His children will be running everything. That's not separation. He can influence public policy in ways that affect the business. And even if he's not looking at the sheets, he would know what's good and what's not good for his golf courses, his branding, his real estate holdings. This, you know, this pertains to how we invest in infrastructure, what we do with our federal labor policy, what do we do with land use, what do we do with the environment. These are all issues which, as someone who is deeply still embedded in business relationships, will think about how that affects the business. And he probably will have a good sense, just as many of us would, what will be good or bad for his holdings. And that's before we get into the kind of international questions, which raise their own set of conflicts as well.
His lawyer made the argument that given the nature of his holdings and the fact that the name itself is sort of the brand, that it would be almost impossible to create a blind trust. Does that hold water to you?
There is an argument that it'd be impossible to completely separate oneself given the very complicated nature and also very well-recognized branding that goes on. If that's the case, the real answer is complete divestment. And I know there's arguments, and many people have said that's unfair, it's unreasonable, he wouldn't get full market value for it. I'd argue he would probably get full market value. But even if you say it's unfair, this man has built up this business for all these years, that might simply just be the cost of pursuing the highest office in the land. There are other forms of sacrifices public servants make every day, from the lowest person on the GS scale to Supreme Court justices who have to cloister themselves more or less from a lot of the conversations of the day.
I want to ask you about the difference between optics and law.
Yeah.
And here I want to play some sound from the president-elect from this news conference this week, where he basically says there is no law that applies. Let's listen to that.
But I don't want to take advantage of something. I have something that others don't have. Vice President Pence also has it. I don't think he'll need it. I have a feeling he's not going to need it. But I have a no conflict of interest provision as president.
Is he right?
We've seen arguments of this in various sorts. We've seen arguments where the president has suggested that he can't be ex parte in a government adjudication because he is.
What does that mean for a mortal like me?
Sorry. There's this old case in which the president was alleged to interfere with an ongoing deliberation about a waiver to the Endangered Species Act. And the president made the argument that I can't be ex parte. I can't be someone with a conflict in this case because I'm the president. And the court shot that down. I think the reasoning is simply that the president is the person who has the most conflicts. The president is someone who is least capable of recusing him or herself from a matter of national consequence. It's easy if you are one of 30 government procurement officers in the Air Force to say, you know what, I have a brother-in-law who works there. Let me work on some other issue. The president can't do that. The president shouldn't do that. And we would have a very weak and challenged executive branch if the president were to say, oh, this involves land use. Oh, this involves labor law. I can't get involved. So we're in a position where we essentially have to let him remain president and hold our breath on a lot of these conflicts.
I want to bring up the word emoluments, which I think a lot of people who are not law professors like you are learning for the first time. This part of the Constitution that says, you know, basically we can't take gifts from basically an elected official, king, leader of the country, et cetera, can't take gifts from foreign powers. Can you explain how it applies here? Because Trump's lawyer said it doesn't really apply to him.
Yeah, it's another argument I don't see his way. So this is part of the Constitution, and it essentially says that any person holding an office of profit or trust under the United States, unless Congress grants an explicit waiver, shall not accept presents, offices, titles, or emoluments from any king, prince, or foreign state. Now, what that means is, a title makes enough sense, office makes enough sense, but emolument is a salary, fee, or profit from employment or office.
So that's the catchy
part. That's just the definition. And the most important language in that constitutional provision is of any kind, whatever.
So that would include a hotel room, say, at a Trump hotel?
This would, to me, be a fee, salary, or profit from employment or office. So if Trump is in the service industry and someone is patronizing his industry, who's a foreign head of state, well, then we have a problem there.
A lot of this stuff seems archaic and complicated. How does a regular voter make sense of it and kind of understand where it might impact my daily life?
Here's the tricky part. It's really up to the citizens because it's very hard to envision a scenario in which the courts would have a sharp legal challenge to a lot of the concerns of conflicts of interest. So it actually is even more incumbent on the citizenry to use judgment, use the political process to express discomfort at various opportunities. As a citizen, what are you worried about? The big concern here is public corruption and not being able to have faith in the decisions that the executive branch is making because there's always this residual uncertainty whether this has a profit motive in the back of the president's mind. Or maybe the president doesn't even have these interests, but everyone around him assumes he does and are making efforts to support him or ingratiate themselves with him or please him by doing things that are, say, pro-Trump organization friendly. So how it trickles down into our lives, one could be concerned about, again, when I was saying before about how is infrastructure policy going to be laid out? How is federal labor law? How is healthcare? All these things matter to the Trump organization as much as it matters to you or me. So I think it breeds a degree of skepticism and distrust which is particularly problematic in this case, given that the president-elect has spent a good deal of time discrediting and at times even savaging core institutions of trust, whether it be the media, the intelligence community, judges who are of Mexican descent. We have all these instances in which this administration-elect is setting up a situation in which we're not supposed to trust these institutions. But yet at the same time, we're supposed to trust him.
I want to ask about Jared Kushner, the president-elect's son-in-law, who will be moving to Washington to be some sort of senior advisor. What issues of law are at play with a family member within the administration? After all, we have seen that before, certainly in the Kennedy administration.
Yeah, so we have anti-nepotism laws. There is some question about how much that applies to confidential assistance to the president. And again, this would not come up as a likely come up as an issue that the courts would ever be able to entertain, largely because as a confidential advisor, you're not making specific decisions that carry the force of law. So again, we have to think in terms of kind of what is the appearances of impropriety? What does this suggest about the White House and the type of advice the president is getting? I would give to Kushner's credit, he does seem to be divesting himself fully. And that only puts into sharper relief the fact that the president-elect has not followed suit.
You said something really interesting before we came into the studio, which was looking at Jared Kushner's business and Rex Tillerson's business as different models of accountability and how that might translate over into government service. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah. So there's a gigantic movement, a very powerful movement to run government more like a business. And this is bipartisan. This has been going on for decades. And there are various virtues and vices with a model of that sort. But oftentimes when we think about a more business-like model, we're thinking of corporations, corporate leaders who have a CEO style of management that's a little bit more decisive, a little bit less bureaucratic. That's the theory. But even when we go down that route, we have CEOs who are part of major organizations that have various competing stakeholders that CEOs are answerable to. Rex Tillerson had a board of directors. He had stakeholders. He had the SEC. There were a number of people to whom he was accountable. It's not clear that kind of real estate scions such as Kushner have a similar set of experiences. The real estate industry is not public. You know, these are not publicly traded corporations. The disclosures are murky. We know that we don't even have the president-elect's tax forms. So it does raise questions about kind of a disposition and a mentality for how do you work in an institution that's as answerable and accountable as the office of the executive branch should be.
John Michaels, professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of the things we do here is ask people in the spotlight, writers, actors, musicians, to share what they've learned about work, money, and life. This week, we've got a guest from inside the APM family.
Hi, I'm Chris Thiele, and I am a musician. I play the mandolin, I sing, I write, and I host a radio program called A Prairie Home Companion.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
I'm going to go with... It can buy you Barolo.
What is that?
That is my favorite kind of wine. It's made from the grape Nebbiolo and comes from the Piedmont region of Italy, up there sort of in the northwest. So I'm going from life experience here that it can't buy you happiness, but it definitely can buy you Barolo, which is happiness of a certain sort.
In a next life, what would your career be?
I guess I would love to try writing. I would love to try writing or playing tennis.
Do you play tennis now?
No, I can't on account of the mandolin. I tried. I love tennis so much. And one of my favorite things to do is practice mandolin while watching Roger Federer play tennis. it's fun, you know, just watching him do what he does. There's so many lessons there for anyone who's attempting to do something well. The ability to shake off a mistake, you know, the concept of being able to lose a battle and not the war, that sort of thing. And just the importance of just being oneself in the midst of an important activity and letting your body and your mind and your heart do the things that they know how to do.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
One thing that's really hard is turning it off, turning thinking about it off in an effort to be 100% present with the people that you love at the end of the day. You know, so for instance, my wife and my little boy, it's not that I don't have the energy for them at the end of the day. It's whether I can turn my thoughts about, you know, these various things that I'm attempting to do. It's whether I can turn those thoughts off and just and be there, be a husband and be a father, which are crucially important to happiness. And, you know, to not miss these beautiful moments with my little boy as he's learning how to be a person, and to not miss the communion, the fellowship with my wife as those things are happening, or just those moments that we can share together as he's accomplished, as little Calvin's maybe accomplishing this or that thing.
When did you realize music could be an actual career?
Oh, I know I was 2 years old when I told my parents I wanted to be a mandolin player.
Really?
Yeah. I think I was dimly aware that was a way that you could just be in the world, that was something that you could be and that would be enough.
At 2 years old, how did you know what a mandolin was?
We were going to this pizza place every Saturday night at that point where there was a bluegrass band, and the leader of the band played the mandolin. He was a very charismatic fellow and also a very good player, and I wanted to do what he did.
Do you remember the first time you were paid to perform?
Yeah, I was 7, I think. And I'm pretty sure that it was for an old folks' home. I remember playing for them, and you know, I was such a ham. I was 7 years old. I'm a ham now. I was an even bigger ham then. And, you know, I can remember just eating all that attention up, you know, and they come up to me afterwards and talk about the performance and maybe pinch my cheek. And I, you know, loving every minute of it, you know, practically presenting the cheek for pinching. I think I've always kind of eaten it up, and then, you know, to get, I think, a check for $50 or something. I think I wanted to spend it on baseball cards, but was not allowed to. There was never really like a light switching on saying I could do this for a living. It was that what I already was doing it for a living, basically.
What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
A coffee machine. A good coffee machine. You should have a good coffee machine, and you should acquire a taste for coffee. I think that you should know your soul. You should know your own coffee soul. You should know what sort of coffee you like, and you should have a device with which to make it well every morning. I believe so ardently in the importance of a routine that propels one into the tasks of the day. I understand that caffeine is a drug and that dependency is, you know, a dangerous state to be in. And I certainly, I guess, am coffee dependent.
Do you go from coffee to wine, or is there a midday drink in the middle?
Zone. Yeah, there's a dead zone, sadly. It would be great. And then there are certainly days when the coffee goes right up into the wine, or the coffee goes up into a cocktail, goes into some wine. I sound like someone with a major problem, huh? and perhaps I do. I don't think I do. Actually, everything in moderation, including moderation itself.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
You can squeeze the life out of something through perfectionism, that you can reach a point of diminishing returns. I think just being able to pull back from something and realize that it is done, it's good. It's good, and working on it more is not going to make it better. In fact, it could make it worse. And instead, turn that focus and that care and that instinct to work hard on to the next thing. I wish I had gotten that piece of advice a little earlier.
You can catch Chris Thiele on A Prairie Home Companion on your local public radio station. It's no secret that we love our numbers here at Marketplace. Doing the numbers is kind of our signature. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
240,000.
That's how many tickets have been distributed for Donald Trump's inauguration next week.
Another 150,000 protesters are also expected to show up.
That means local businesses and merch sellers are kicking into high gear.
The new business boom started on election night when Trump supporters rushed to book flights and hotels.
One bar and hotel owner told us alcohol sales have been consistently high since November, thanks to celebrations and self-medication. $25,000.
That's how much BuzzFeed sold in merchandise, proudly declaring itself a failing pile of garbage this week.
President-elect Donald Trump described the company that way at a press conference. Hours later, BuzzFeed was selling T-shirts and a garbage can.
Proceeds are going to the Committee to Protect Journalists. $250,000.
That's how much prices jumped in just 2 weeks for an undeveloped acre of land in rural California, one real estate agent told us this week.
Since recreational marijuana became legal in the state, there's been a scramble to buy land and retail space.
Regulators are still working out where growers and sellers could operate, and the process could take about a year.
You could say the green rush is the new gold rush.
No one says that.
As you probably know by now, President-elect Donald Trump likes to tweet. And one side effect of this is his ability to seemingly make policy and move markets. Companies like Toyota, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin have all had their stocks dip after he tweeted about them. Now, our generic reminder, if you've got stocks President-elect Trump is tweeting about in your 401k, sit tight. Long-term investors should generally leave their money alone. But for active traders and for the SEC, how do you handle all this? Marketplace senior tech correspondent Molly Wood is here to talk about it. Hi, Molly.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
We are in obviously uncharted territory with the president-elect tweeting in this way, but is market volatility based off social media a new thing?
You know, market volatility based off the tweets of one person, I think, is a new thing. It is not new necessarily for the market and for investors to look to any new fast-moving source of information to make decisions and make investment decisions. And so I think we've seen a trend in social media affecting and impacting the market. But the more recent kind of acute trend is this idea that Donald Trump will tweet about something and it will affect immediately a particular company's stock. But, you know, look, traders and investors are always looking for an edge, and that edge only comes from information. So it's not that surprising that there would be sort of an immediate and emotional response to information coming out in this way that they perceive could be a possible advantage.
We've already seen this one app trigger basically work a system where you can get an alert that the president-elect is tweeting about something you hold. What do you think of an app like that?
Yeah, I mean, you have to say way to capitalize on the trend quickly, right? It sounds like this app was an existing project that was about setting up real-time alerts when there's any news about a particular stock, and they sort of cleverly reshaped it to include this Trump trigger. So it still does all of those other things. It still is sort of a broad notification app, but it now includes this Trump trigger, which I think is something that delights journalists even more than traders and investors themselves. Because let's be honest, even the impact that we've seen from the occasional tweet or something that's in a press conference or something that's in a public statement, it's been relatively small, all things considered. Now, yes, Toyota lost, you know, $1.2 billion in market cap, but most of that recovered. What we're seeing is blips. And so I don't think that that really serious investors are going to be using the Trump trigger as a way to get in on the action, because for one thing, everybody hears it all at the same time. It's not like you're getting a secret insider information.
Well, one thing you're getting at there, though, is the ability of one person to move markets. And back when I covered the Treasury Department, you know, they were very careful to not say or do anything during trading hours. But
you're talking about a new paradigm here. Yep. So do we have, I guess, the regulatory apparatus in place to even think about markets moving in response to social media from the president?
Yeah, I think that that is actually the central question. And, you know, does the SEC need to have some sort of framework that is about Twitter specifically, or about social media, or about whether the president is allowed to tweet about business in this way? I mean, I think that we are, as you've pointed out, in totally uncharted territory. That's probably part of the reason that there is such an immediate response to these tweets, because no one knows exactly what's going to happen. They don't know if the comments are going to be followed by action. And the other question that I think it's fair to ask is, who else knows what President Trump is going to tweet before he tweets it?
Well, that brings up the possibility for insider trading.
Exactly. And I think that that is going to become a reasonable question to ask. So I think, you know, the more serious question to be asked is the one that you asked, which is, what is the regulatory framework? What should it look like? Because the trend is not going to go away. I don't think there's any question that this is something that is going to continue, that companies are going to be materially affected by, even if it's small or temporary compared to the movement of the larger market. And so how do we address it?
What does Silicon Valley think of this?
You know, Silicon Valley is in such an interesting position because on the one hand, it is very self-congratulatory in terms of the products that it's created that allow all of this information to get out, to allow it to get out in real time and allow it to be part of the national conversation. But at the same time, I think they have to be concerned. I haven't heard the Valley necessarily talk about what's going to happen if the SEC starts to regulate Twitter as a potential market mover. But I would imagine that those are conversations that are going to start happening soon, because these platforms, you know, whether they make money or not, in the case of Twitter, are very powerful. And it's time to start having real conversations about how that power is wielded.
Marketplace's senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
In the past few weeks, there has been a lot of news about Russia, from the DNC hacking to the intelligence community's conversations with President-elect Trump about Russia. President Obama recently issued new sanctions against the country. We wanted to take a step back, though, and get a better sense of the economic and political relationship between the U.S. and Russia, and what might change now. We reached out to Matthew Rojansky. He's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I want to zoom out a little bit, because I think a lot of people are hearing all sorts of things about Russia. So from a layman's terms, you know, what's the picture on the ground for the regular Russian? Are the oligarchs kind of off in their own world, or off in the world of those who kind of interact with state-run oil companies? What do regular Russians see?
Well, Russia, of course, is an enormous country, literally the largest country on Earth, 11 time zones, 145 million people. So it's never possible to say what Russians think across the board. But a lot of, well-informed, I'd say reasonably well-off Russians, the new middle class, as relatively small as that is, but you're still talking about, a dozen plus major cities across the Russian Federation where you have a considerable number of working professionals. Those folks, I think, tend to be very, very tuned in to world affairs. I would even argue, on average, much more so than the average American citizen. And part of the reason for that is that Russia is very sensitive across the board. I mean, this is from the very tip-top of the political and economic elite, down even to your cross-sectional, you know, factory worker, farmer, small village resident, very, very sensitive about status. And the issue over the last 25 years has been an enormous loss of status, literally within the lifetime of working-age Russians today, including the Russian leadership. And so a lot of what Russians think about when they look at the U.S.-Russia relationship, global issues, international security issues is, you know, what role is Russia playing? Are Russia's interests being respected? Is Russia's status being respected? And that's one of the reasons at the end of the day why Vladimir Putin has remained so popular in Russia, above 70%, even 80% popularity ratings consistently, you know, for a decade. I mean, these are inconceivable numbers by almost any Western political standards. And they're not really manipulated. These are real numbers, and it's because Russians look at what he's achieved in terms of really enhancing Russia's status and the degree to which Russian interests have to be considered by other major global actors, and they're very pleased with that.
You know, we don't do a lot of trade with Russia. It's a very small number. How would you describe our economic relationship with Russia?
Very small. That's basically right, that we don't do a lot of trade. Overall, it's less than 0.5%. I think even less than 0.1% of total U.S. trade volume with the world. We tend to do well in certain distinct areas. And that's part of the reason why when you see sanctions imposed on the Russian economy, and this really came out, of course, in the Tillerson hearing, it tends to be certain industries that are most concerned about that because they get hit very hard. But it really doesn't hit the American economy across the board. That's very different from Europe, of course, because Europe has a much larger trading relationship with Russia, roughly tenfold where the U.S. was at its height.
How has the American-Russian relationship changed over the course of the Obama presidency?
It's changed, you could say, in the same way that U.S.-Russia relations evolve under almost every president, arguably every post-Cold War U.S. president, Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama, all set out to have this very, first of all, personal relationship with their Russian counterpart. I refer to the Bill and Boris show of the 1990s. Remember George W. Bush saying he had looked into Putin's eyes and seen his soul. Right. And then of course, Obama with the reset and thinking that Dmitry Medvedev was going to be his partner in totally changing the dynamic of U.S.-Russia relations. And then every one of those administrations ended in a substantially worse place than when they started in terms of almost every measure, you know, security, democracy and human rights, trade and economics, almost on every measure. The fact that Obama has not been an exception is unexceptional. Do we necessarily then write it off and say, okay, well, the new administration will end up where previous administrations have ended? Not necessarily. I think the sad fact of U.S.-Russia relations is that we tend to repeat the same mistakes over and over. One of my favorites is not recognizing that Russians have their own interests, imagining that we can sort of come into conversations with Russians, lay out what we think their interests are, show them where the overlap is, and then expect them to sign on the dotted line. And we keep doing that, and it really doesn't work. So I think just more effective diplomacy in general. And I was actually pleased with the Tillerson statement, the written statement that he submitted and that he read at the beginning of the hearing. It simply said, you know, we failed to recognize that Russians don't think the way we do, at least not on all issues, not all the time. That's a good sign, I think, for negotiating with the Russians, which is something he has a lot of experience with.
When we think about the U.S. relationship with Russia, you know, we are no longer this sort of Cold War enemies. But when we think certainly about economics, it seems to me, and I'd like you to kind of expand on this, that a lot of what we are doing is kind of bank shot stuff to affect our allies within Europe.
Yeah, there's definitely been a big element of the United States as kind of the voice outside the room. So I think it was Archimedes who said, give me a long enough lever and I can move the world. The problem for the United States is that we seek to use economic sanctions as a lever, but in our case, it's not very long, and we also don't really have a place to stand because, as you pointed out earlier, we really don't have an economic relationship. Over time, we may actually do damage to the system that gives us whatever leverage we have. So, for example, the global financial and trading system in which we have a very privileged and fortunate position, we are definitely sending a signal to the Russians, and then the Russians kind of amplify that signal to many others, especially emerging economies, but also emerged economies like China, that, you know, really we can't play within this system safely because, you know, the United States is going to come after us and they're going to pressure the Europeans into coming after us as soon as they disagree with us about anything, whether it's human rights or some kind of national security issue. And so they will increasingly hedge against that system. And I think the comfortable assumption that we'll be able to use economic leverage indefinitely to achieve any foreign policy objective is probably a wrong assumption. And I think Russia's busily proving that.
Well, what do you think that then means with the sort of various rounds of sanctions that have been imposed, both the ones about sort of Ukraine and Crimea and this latest round?
I'm reminded of, I think it was something that Don Rumsfeld said about the Iraq invasion, which is, you know, you go to war with the army you had, not the army you wish you had.
Yeah.
And the same is true with this foreign policy challenge of sanctions, which is the new administration is going to come in with the sanctions policy that we have. Part of that is what the previous administration has already put into place by executive order, what the Europeans have done more or less in concert with that, and also what Congress will legislate. And Congress is, literally has pending legislation now, bipartisan, both chambers sponsoring, so you know, I would say very likely to pass, that will codify, that will legislate sanctions against Russia on Ukraine, Syria, and a number of related issues. So that's what the administration will inherit. And I think that the challenge is going to be, if you're skeptical about sanctions, and I have been skeptical, of course, the Secretary nominee Tillerson has been skeptical, you nonetheless don't want to give up something for nothing. And so I think you want to maintain a tough bargaining position where you say, look, okay, you know, we're willing to consider relief of sanctions, but it's got to be in exchange for something. So what is the off-ramp from the pressure strategy look like, and not just concessions for nothing, and not just indefinite pressure. As long as we disagree with you, we're going to maintain this punishment strategy, because the concern there would be 50 years later, it's Cuba and some enterprising president in 2065 says, gee, it's time to lift the sanctions on Russia, you know, gets a round of applause and very little was achieved.
Matthew Wojcicki, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. On next week's show, a new president, new policies, a new way of doing business. It is a new era. And we'll continue our exploration of what that means for all of us. Don't forget to visit us at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez and Brian Allison are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.